Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, our country's deepening economic hole. Despite governors' efforts to reopen state economies, this week's jobless numbers brought more bad news. 2.4 million new unemployment claims. That makes almost 39 million jobs lost since the pandemic began. But that economic pain is not being spread evenly. In fact, if you read the work of The Atlantic's Annie Lowry, it becomes obvious that the financial impacts of the coronavirus are highlighting and exaggerating the inequalities that already existed in our economy. Annie Lowry joined me to talk about who is hurting most and what the government can do about it. Annie, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
We got new jobless numbers, adding 2.4 million more people out of work, taking us up to something like 38.6 million people out of work. Tell us who this is hitting most.
What we know right now is that certain sectors have been hit particularly hard, and that certain wage bands or earnings bands have been hit particularly hard. So if you were a higher income office worker, it is likelier that your work has translated into a work from home scenario or that your industry has been less hit. But if you were working in hospitality, in food service, in something like, you know, hotels, events, those kinds of things, very likely you have lost your job. And roughly 40% of people making less than $40,000 a year have seen either a significant reduction in hours or have been laid off just in the past 2 months, which is utterly unprecedented.
So it's clear this is affecting the entire economy. Tell me how it's affecting the economy.
So we've gone through this period where public fear over the coronavirus pandemic and legal shutdowns have led to tens of millions of Americans staying home, which often necessitates a job loss. But we are in this phase where those job losses are becoming permanent because we are seeing business failures. Businesses are not, even with all the government support coming, they're not able to pay their bills and remain viable. So we're seeing mass layoffs that are likely to become permanent. So in this way, this what we had hoped would be a severe but temporary disruption is becoming a self-generating recession that will be with us for a very long time.
When you say a very long time, what do you mean?
So there had been hope that we would have something like a V-shaped rebound, so a really sharp drop in economic activity, followed by a really sharp rebound, hopefully to roughly where we were in the winter. And so the expectation is that we will have a sharp rebound, but that we're not going to get all the way back up to where we were or really anything like it. We're expected to have unemployment that will be very, very high for a long matter of months. So the economy might be doing better, but it will still be in a very weakened state. And we aren't anticipated to hit the same GDP number or the same employment number for many, many months, if not years at this point.
So that's going to hit and hurt different segments of the population in different ways. Let's start with the millennials. Talk about how they will be affected.
So new entrants to the labor market, people who were leaving high school or leaving college or one way or another joining the labor market, are probably the most vulnerable here. They don't have a long resume, and we have many studies that show that entering the job market during a downturn has a lifetime effect on earnings. So it makes it much less likely that you'll be able to find a job. And even two decades later, you'll be making less. So we saw this with the college class of 2008 and 2009, and we're likely to see it with the class of 2020 and 2021. And as a general point, younger workers are more vulnerable here. They were more heavily concentrated in workplaces like restaurants, like retail stores, like stadiums and concert halls and movie theaters that have been shut down. And therefore, we are seeing much higher rates of joblessness for the young than for older workers, though obviously everybody has been hit. This is just a massive pandemic. It's just somewhat more severe for the young.
And what about the young who are graduating from college, going on to professional schools like medicine, law, architecture? What about them?
They are probably in a fairly good position. There's a phenomenon that some social scientists, like economists, describe as sheltering in school. So when the labor market is bad, students will remain in school for longer. Maybe they'll go get a master's degree or a professional degree. Maybe they'll pick up an additional certification instead of joining the job market. So it's too soon to say how much that's happening. But one of the things that's unusual here is that you are seeing a number of educational institutions that, due to the shutdown, are not sure that they will survive. And you're also seeing this transition to online learning that has been very difficult for many institutions, particularly ones without giant endowments and a lot of resources. And so there's actually fewer educational opportunities out there in some sense. Additionally, for people who were going to spend a lot of money and take on a lot of debt to go to a professional school, to not be able to go in person, to not have that on-campus experience, which it looks like for many schools that's not going to happen for months, again, perhaps not until 2021, that's changing the calculus. You know, do you really want to spend $30,000 or $40,000 a year and take out student loans if you're not going to have that campus experience? And that's a choice that's facing millions of young people that, you know, that didn't happen in the 2001 recession or the 2008 recession or recessions before. It was an option to go live on campus, and now it really isn't.
So how would you compare this to, say, what happened during the Great Depression?
So the economy was very different during the Great Depression. It was much more based on manufacturing and agriculture, whereas now it's much more of a white-collar service information economy. And in some ways, that's good because those jobs can safely be performed at home. There are many jobs that are vulnerable and that have become more dangerous. So jobs like care jobs, both in healthcare and in things like elder care and child care, that's been a really big growth sector for the economy. And that's very at risk because of the risk of the pandemic. Workers on those front lines who often aren't making a tremendous amount of money, are essential workers, are also more at risk of becoming sick and perhaps even dying due to the pandemic. And so that's one big difference. Also, notably, during the Great Depression, it took a while for the government, years and years and years, for the government to do the kind of spending that jolted the economy back, right? For the New Deal to come into place, there was a decade of extraordinary economic pain before that happened. And this time, we've already seen the government stepping in to do huge amounts of deficit spending, which is our absolute path to recovery. It's really necessary for the federal government to spend a tremendous amount now to help make states, cities, and households whole.
And yet, on that point, many Republicans and the president included are saying enough is enough. Is it enough to pull people back in?
Absolutely not. So if the government cut back on things like unemployment insurance payments, if the federal government does not help states and cities with their budget crises, this is going to be a much worse recession than it needs to be. And so right now, what we have is a situation where households are cutting back because they're losing jobs or they're fearing job losses, so they're saving money. And states and cities are seeing dramatic losses in things like sales tax income. And they therefore are going to have to lay workers off. And we saw this during the Great Recession because they don't have that same capacity to deficit spend like the federal government does. They can't issue bonds as easily. And so we need the federal government to step in and to replace that. It's sometimes called the output gap. The federal government needs to fill it. It needs to spend as much as everybody is pulling back to get us out of this. If they don't do that, it's going to mean a much worse and a much longer recession. The economy is not going to rebound as quickly as it would otherwise. So I actually remember talking to you during the last recession where the gap was about $2 trillion and the stimulus package was about $1 trillion. It was undershot by about half. And here we have a less good sense of how big the gap is. We've already spent roughly $3 trillion, but we need to spend as much as it takes to fill that bucket back up.
Going back to millennials, I've seen a report that 52% of people under the age of 45 has lost a job, been put on leave, or had their hours reduced due to the pandemic. Good grief. I mean, that truly is a massive figure.
It's enormous. It is so much sharper and more sudden and more severe and more violent than the Great Recession, which was a tremendous generational cataclysm. This is huge. And a lot of what's been disappearing is the kind of informal or gig work that people use to keep the bills paid on top of formal work that they might do. So maybe you do some babysitting, maybe you drive an Uber, maybe you do some landscaping. All of that is gone, and there's really no place for people to turn right now. And hopefully, if we were talking in a couple months, things would look better as things reopen. But for now, it's very bleak out there.
What about African Americans? Death rates are certainly higher because of the virus. What about job losses?
So we have seen both for younger workers and workers of color, Black and Latinx workers, and especially young Black men, a resurgence of unemployment back to Great Depression levels. These are workers that tended to be more vulnerable and tended to face more discrimination in the workplace and more shunting into more dangerous and lower wage work to begin with. This is amplifying those inequalities hugely. Everybody is experiencing some pain, but not everybody is experiencing the same pain. And I think of the workers that we want to worry about the most, that we want to provide the most help to, young Black men are among that cohort that will need more help to help make them whole and to make sure they are attached to the labor force and that there are good jobs available. And we have a number of policies that can help do that, but we haven't seen the kind of policy response that would mean the creation of those jobs.
So you're saying the money is not necessarily going where it's needed most.
I think that we needed a quick rescue of businesses and a quick shunting of money to the healthcare system and some bailouts, right? We needed the emergency rescue package, which Congress passed. But now we are in this phase where we're moving to just a sustained recession and we need different policies, both general policies just to keep the economy going and specific policies to help people who need a little bit more assistance, whose work and ingenuity we want to make sure are tapped into for the strength of the economy as a whole. So something like subsidized jobs initiatives, where the government helps provide a private business with some salary for a worker, will be really necessary and really cost effective in this next phase of the crisis.
What about things like a work program for the highways, for example?
Absolutely. So we have all sorts of infrastructures. We know a lot about how to do this. Things like the Conservation Corps, public jobs works. There's no end of schools that need renovations and highways that need fixing. Those kind of things would be really effective, as well as, again, programs that help subsidize hiring in the public sector. And then also money to make sure that educational and training initiatives stay open and that they are affordable for young workers, so that younger folks can say, you know what, I've decided I'm going to go get the certification to become a plumber or a welder or an electrician. You know, let's make sure that people have that option for those good jobs that we know that we're going to need more of in a few years.
So what's standing in the way of those kinds of assistance programs?
We just haven't seen Congress turn to the mass funding of initiatives like that yet. And again, Congress has done a lot. It's spent a lot of money. The PPP, the Payroll Protection Program aimed for small businesses, has had a lot of problems, but it has also helped millions of businesses out and kept workers on the payroll. And again, I think as we are moving to this next phase where we're just going to need recessionary programs to help with jobs and training, that's what we're going to need is more assistance, targeted assistance to help keep our workforce ready for the future and to make sure that people are employed.
More of my conversation with Annie Lowry when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Annie Lowry. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she writes about economic policy and politics. Annie, you recently wrote a piece in support of the cancel rent movement. Tell me about that.
So the cancel rent movement is pointing to the fact that millions of people are unable to continue to pay rent through this pandemic. They have no option because of the job losses that they've experienced to continue keeping their big bills paid. So there have been, both at the federal level and the state and local level, a number of eviction moratoria put in place during the pandemic. So it's preventing people from being thrown out on the street, but that doesn't prevent them from accruing debt to their landlord. So that's a huge risk to those families, especially we worry about families with children. And then it's also a risk to the landlords, who are then absorbing large losses and often are not particularly wealthy themselves and often have mortgages to pay. So you're seeing those losses drift up the chain into mortgages, into the financial system, to banks, to investors. And so there's a lot of ways to tackle that problem. Probably the best way would be just to keep people paid and working so that they don't have to face the prospect of eviction. But there's been a movement to actually just have the federal government step in and pay rents or mortgages. And so I think you can argue about whether that's the most effective way for the government to help prevent a financial crisis and keep families whole. We are now starting to see the outlines of some knock-on crises from the original pandemic and shutdown-induced recession. So things like educational institution closures. I think that there's a very good chance that we are going to see a housing and eviction crisis if we don't do more. You know, perhaps mass joblessness among the young. States and cities are in a fiscal crisis. Gosh, I mean, we could just go top to bottom. It's such a big, complicated issue, right? Rural hospital closings, doctor's offices going belly up, just a general bankruptcy crisis. And so this is a very, very hard puzzle. And it's really incumbent on the federal government to start working it out because nobody else has the resources to.
So is this cancel rent movement catching on?
It is. So, you know, there has been a lot of state and local interest in rent cancellation. We've seen two bills in Congress that would forgive rents and mortgages. And there's even been some interest on the Republican side in at least preventing evictions, even if they don't want to make people whole. But I think one issue has been that this is such a big, complicated, overwhelming crisis that it's frankly been hard for Congress and the federal agencies to manage. As time goes on, I think this will become a growing problem that will need to be addressed somehow because we can't have a mass of evictions. That's not good for landlords either. And so there's going to need to be some kind of aid, whether, again, that comes through the income side or whether it comes through the mortgages and rent side.
So we're seeing a majority of states opening up and allowing freedom of movement. Is that going to take care of some of the problem, at least in the short term, praying that it doesn't incite a greater growth of the virus?
Yes, it will certainly help. However, what we have seen is that even when places, and this is something we have seen both here locally in the United States and abroad in our peer countries, is that opening up in and of itself doesn't bring the economy back. So for instance, the state of Georgia said restaurants are open, things like hair salons, tattoo parlors even are open. But when you look at the economic activity being generated in those places, it hasn't rebounded much. I think that restaurant bookings, restaurant meals in Atlanta were still down something like 85% to their prior level. So people are afraid, they're not coming back, and people are out of work, they don't have money to spend. So I think that it is probably necessary, but not sufficient. We can't account on the economy just coming back by itself. It's not like switching off and turning on a computer.
Do we have any idea yet to what extent these loans to small business have helped?
We do. So we have at least some data coming from the Treasury and the Small Business Administration on the number of loans that have been issued and the amount of money going out to businesses. And it really has helped. We also know something about the number of jobs attached to those businesses, but it was a time-limited effort. And one thing that is clear is that, you know, 75% of the money needed to be used on payroll and on 8 weeks of payroll. But already it's clear that the economic downturn is going to last much longer than that. So it might have just delayed layoffs and business failures as opposed to preventing them. That's one issue that we're starting to see. The second big question is that there were some strings attached with the money. And so businesses that don't meet the terms of the loan won't have it forgiven, right? Instead of being granted the money, they'll have to pay it back. A lot of businesses saddled with a new large loan, even if the interest rate is really low, are not going to be able to do that. And so we could have just delayed a lot of business failures instead of preventing them. And we don't have a good sense yet. It's still very early days as to how many we've prevented, how many jobs we've saved, and just how many job losses we've delayed and how many business failures we've delayed.
And of course, we've read and seen how many large businesses got lots of money that was really supposed to go to smaller businesses. How did that happen, Annie?
I think that the fundamental thing that happened was that this got put together pretty quickly, and the rulemaking process happened very quickly. So in the initial, there were two tranches of PPP money, at least thus far. In the initial tranche, it was possible for some franchise businesses to access the loans. And there was just some kind of paperwork chicanery. So very large businesses, even public companies, were able to access the money. Normally, we thought that there would be a sort of 500-person employment cap. But some businesses that actually had more than 500 employees were able to access the funds. And on one hand, that meant that there was less money for small businesses because this wasn't an open-ended commitment. It was first come, first serve, and bigger and better connected businesses got in line first because their banks made sure that they got in line first.
Exactly.
And then more broadly, you know, there was no mechanism to decide who was the most deserving, which was probably good because we just needed the money to go out so fast. But millions of deserving businesses were unable to access this cash. And, you know, Congress could have made it open-ended. They could have said every business that needs it is going to get this help, but they didn't do that. They just appropriated a set amount of money and then kind of tossed it to the pack of wolves.
And, of course, here in the district, which is still closed down, you had small business owners who were told that they'd have to use that money to pay their employees right away, but they couldn't open their businesses. So by the time they opened their businesses, that money was gone.
Oh, absolutely. And the other issue is that, you know, in places with high rent costs, a lot of businesses, you know, they have costs beyond payroll, insurance, utilities, rent. And so if you had no prospect of your business reopening and you had high overhead costs, you were still left with quite the conundrum. And a number of small businesses have had to stop paying rent or gone into arrears or seeking other loans or relief funds or are turning to options like GoFundMe. It's very difficult, very challenging business environment.
So all of this seems to be pushing Democratic presumptive presidential candidate Joe Biden toward making very bold proposals. Can you talk about those and how they might bring the economy back more quickly?
Absolutely. So I think that just as a general point, Democrats in Congress have been pushing alongside their Republican colleagues for Congress to go far bigger than we saw during the Great Recession, which is important, really, really important. And so the Biden team has started to put out a slate of response proposals that are kind of right-sized to the challenge, I would say. So, you know, things like, you know, mortgage forgivenesses and jobs programs, reunionization efforts, efforts for frontline pandemic workers, as well as things that would help with the health of the country too. So moving towards true universal healthcare, Though, of course, Biden has preferred to remain in the system that we currently have, the employer-sponsored system, not something like Medicare for All. I also think that we will see in the coming months more concrete proposals from the Biden team. So I'm not certain on this, but I know that there is a lot of discussion about doing something like a jobs guarantee, some kind of very, very big lefty proposal, or, you know, perhaps not the Green New Deal, but some kind of infrastructure revitalization. Again, I think that we'll see more proposals like that coming. In some ways, I think that the more interesting thing is that we've seen relatively little from the Trump team in terms of an economic rescue proposal or plan. I anticipate that we'll see more coming from them, given that Trump will have to answer for this recession. But at least from the campaign, we haven't seen sort of a large comprehensive rescue proposal yet. I think because the impulse from the White House has been to minimize the extent of the catastrophe here, particularly when it comes to the deaths and the case rates. And there's been a lot of blame shifting to cities and states.
So how badly do you believe that the current economic reality is going to last throughout the summer into the fall and affect President Trump's chances of re-election?
I think that there's a lot of uncertainty given how unusual this all is. This is not a normal recession. The fact that it's coming on this horrific public health crisis that is killing thousands of Americans, nearly 100,000 now, it raises a lot of uncertainty. That said, the economy is going to be very weak on election day. It will probably be recovering. It's probably quite unlikely to be getting worse than it is right now. It's unlikely to still be contracting, I mean, but the actual state of the economy will be terrible. And so I think that that poses a true headwind to the Trump team. And how surmountable that is, we're not sure. There are many other dynamics at play. Again, the fact that the economy will be rebounding, of course, you know, how much the pandemic is still prevalent and even resurging in the fall is a really uncertain thing. And we're very, very polarized as an country, and that really affects how we see and understand the reality of what's going on. So, you know, I think all of those things are uncertain. But Trump was coming into this election with a very, very strong tailwind, if we were talking 2 months ago, given how low the unemployment rate is. Now the unemployment rate is gosh, I mean, well into the teens and is likely to go higher. And so I think a lot of families will be experiencing a lot of pain come the fall.
So we've talked about how much more the government needs to do. The question on many people's minds is, can the government afford to do a lot more?
I think about this in sort of two ways. So answer is yes. The Federal Reserve, which is a very small C conservative institution, is basically begging for more deficit spending. And the issue is that if we don't do more deficit spending now, we will not generate the growth in the economic activity that will be necessary to pay the debts. So we want to be doing a tremendous amount of deficit spending right now to keep people employed, to keep businesses humming, and that will make those debts down the road more affordable. There's a thornier question because we were running very large deficits when the economy was very good. And those deficits weren't buying us a lot of growth. So the Trump tax cuts, for instance, added roughly $2 trillion to the debt over 10 years. There was almost no surge in growth associated with it. It was short and it was temporary. And so that is a little bit painful, right? Because we're going to have to pay for that too. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be deficit spending now. It means we need lots more deficit spending now, especially given that interest rates are so low. So the government is functionally borrowing for free. And if we can take that money, we can keep businesses whole, we can keep families whole, and we can invest in things that will generate more economic activity in the future. So in the health of our citizens, in infrastructure, in highways, in airports, and broadband, all that kind of stuff that we know that it doesn't pay for itself, but it helps to generate economic activity, that would be really, really good.
And before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say?
I know that this was a fairly dark conversation, and I would hope to be wrong. I would hope that things rebound a lot more strongly than I fear that they will. Like, I would be delighted to have had this seem a little bit dark and a little bit cynical. But a lot is at risk right now, and time is of the essence to help make sure that this isn't more painful than it has to be.
Antony, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That was Antony Lowry. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she writes about economic policy and politics. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you want me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to get in touch. What are you finding most challenging? What questions do you have that need answers? You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Please stay safe, be well. I'm Diane Rehm.